I want to read you a passage from our English, an Anglican theologian, Rowan Williams, which I think is rather beautiful on how the notion of the resurrection of Christ affects our openness to the world. This is how that goes. God is that to which all things are present, so theology traditionally affirms. So through the mediation of God, all things can be made present to us again, present through God's presence. The concept of God's memory as holding or keeping open the past overthrows the delusion that we are closed in upon ourselves, because the life of God is not a life with worldly limits, worldly constraints on its possibilities. The memory of suffering here is, we might say, embedded in an inexhaustible life. If you get connected with God, Williams is saying, you get connected with everybody, because God is everywhere present. You're suddenly connected. You're drawn into a relationship with everyone. Just what you thought you might have had to close off or give up on. Now this may strike one as excessively optimistic, but I think it's a kind of margin out there to call us toward it, to call us, I don't know how you folks are, but cynicism lies in wait all the day long. You know, it's so easy to give up and become cynical. Well, that belief in resurrection is a belief which connects us, the resurrection of Jesus, the grave could not hold Jesus, and in a sense, the daily graves of our failures do not hold us. I think that's a way in which there's such a kind of theological doctrine as resurrection has immense ethical implications. The third thing I wanted to mention, from kind of fill in from last night, and tomorrow I'll fill in for today what I didn't get said. It's sort of like using day-old bread. You never use the current supply, you know. But this is Dorothea Zola, and she has written on the subject of suffering. One of the charges, you remember, that we were considering last night is that the Christian faith not only encourages suffering, but it makes you suffer the more because, you know, the charge at least, that it makes you suffer the more because it tells you that this suffering is sent to you by God for some sin. Now you have to try to find the sin, and you figure, I must really be guilty. Well, Zola really critiques that, what she calls Christian sadism and masochism, very forcefully. But then she does go back toward the end of the book, and I hope to read a couple of passages from her later in today's presentation. But she goes on to talk about the way in which a theology of the presence of God, not the omnipotence of God, but the presence of God, the way in which that can affect suffering. And she develops in a very nice way the three stages of suffering. I'd like to just give you that. In the first stage of suffering, one is mute, speechless, in isolation, and powerless. So one cannot communicate. One just locked up in oneself. Nobody seems to understand me. I have no ability to break open that, come out of that. And then she talks about two further stages. In the second stage, one is lamenting. That is crying out, but one is no longer speechless. Anger as a very healthy reality. It's in contact. You're now communicating. You're able to speak. You can find a way of expressing yourself. And maybe there is a certain tone, although I think this might be too optimistic on her part, of acceptance. The third stage of suffering is where you're actually changing the suffering. You're organizing your life to experience solidarity, and you move ahead to change. I don't think she's saying that presence should just help you express your suffering. You should work to change the suffering. But the intermediate stage is the one I kind of wanted to direct attention to. The doctrine of the presence of God makes it possible for us to talk about that. And then the fourth thing from last night, and then I'll be done with that, is I wanted to read you an advertisement that I received. I don't know if there's a Holden paper this could be placed in, but one of the members of the group after the session gave me this advertisement. I thought you might be interested. To hire for the position, God. Here's the job description. Self-limiting, personally imposed, omnipresent, omnicaring, omnipotent, if you take it to mean everywhere powerful, but not necessarily a Big Ten God. not just a large male or female human, but totally other, ambiguous but actual in history, subject to problems but not failure, needed qualities, absolute but requiring a relationship with the actual, willing to struggle with necessity and possibility, for us, that is humankind, with us and in us, creating possibilities in history, not non-negotiable in human intervention, willing to give guidance, prerequisites, no napping during history, willing to work for the long haul, willing to go incarnate, willing to move into every human via the Holy Spirit, able, I don't quite understand this one, well, what did I say last night? Able to attach a bared arm to the rest of the body. I don't remember talking about that. Well, maybe that's an addition. Benefits co-constitutive with humanity, salary range negotiable. Well, that's an interesting summary of some of the stuff we've been talking about this week. Our topic this afternoon is the future of faith, or one might phrase it as, does faith have a future? I think it's clear faith has some kind of a future. In the late 60s, we witnessed the death of God movement, the death of God theology. A lot of bathrooms have this sign in them now saying the death of God theology is dead. I don't think it is really dead. Thomas J.J. Altizer, who is probably the most important of those people, is very much alive and writing. But in any case, the sort of predictions or almost celebration of the death of God certainly has, they have not proven accurate. Spirituality, religion, piety is staging, I think, a comeback. There seems to be a new level of interest. Now, I don't want to sound too cheerful about that, because the question that one might ask is whether that's good news or bad news. It's mixed news, I think. We talked, I think some of you were here, I believe it was Tuesday, although the days do get run together for me, about the fact that religion today is such a polyglot, such a phantasmagoria, such a kaleidoscope, such a zoo. It's such a mess. And I expressed my own feeling of nervousness about, but I can't back away from it, but nervousness about being associated. I too am a religious person. So the fact that piety, faith, religion seems to have a future, all right, not necessarily good news, because there's certainly religion, piety, forms of faith that are repellent. And one would say, if that's what faith is, we'd prefer atheism. But it does seem to have a future, so we're joining into that, trying to talk about that future. I want to focus this afternoon, as I have all week really, on the relationship between people of faith and those who do not have faith, or between the person within herself, between that which is faith and that which is not faith in the person, either within the single individual or between two individuals. I think that's essential to keep that relationship in mind. And the approach that I want to talk about, I didn't put anything on the board this afternoon because I have 9 points, and I sort of despaired of putting them on the board, but there are 9 brief points. I don't expect to talk as fast or as long as I have some of the other days. I think I have sort of transgressed the holding guidelines on occasion. I haven't felt lightning strike me, but I've been a little strange this afternoon, so maybe the warning is getting to me. But it must be that 9-mile hike. Nell and I and Faith and Terry Fredheim have been to Heart Lake, so if I seem to speak with less intensity, you will understand. Some people say that's all the better. Anyway, here is what I want to say about that, as just to get our conversation started. I don't think we can expect a clear-cut resolution. I think the Christian community is going to exist in an increasingly pluralistic environment. I don't think that this is the kind of thing where we will expect to see a sort of shaking out and the emergence of a Christian, if you like this phrase, a sort of Christian culture, where the church is the dominant reality in the culture. There is a kind of nostalgia in us that would some of us, that would make us desire that. Although I think there's often a tendency in religion to desire something in a nostalgic way that actually never existed. Richard Neuhaus has a chapter title which I like in one of his books. The title is Returning to Where We Have Never Been. The kind of giving that old time religion, but it actually wasn't really there, perhaps. We romanticized the past very quickly. I think pluralism is to be expected. I think this is given in two respects. First of all, if it's the case that God is a God who loves freedom, creates and nurtures and nourishes freedom, and that's been a really major emphasis in what I've tried to say. I think it's not idiosyncratic. I think it's an emphasis in the biblical writings and in Christian tradition. If God is such a God, then it does seem strange to expect that the Christian option will somehow become so convincing or prepossessing that people just sort of, why of course, and accept the faith. I think anyone who tries to speak for the faith will need to recognize that we're dealing with a situation of genuine ambiguity. One can make as coherent and winsome a witness as possible, but then I think it's very important that one does not try to apply that last bit of pressure. The Christian faith is not in the body count business. It's not saving people by killing them. It recognizes freedom. It loves freedom. And I think there can be a kind of evangelism, if you care to use that word, that is much in the conversation these days, a kind of evangelism that presses in with such a ferocity that, at some point the poor person will say, well, okay, I convert then. But the question is whether you've actually accomplished anything. A situation of genuine ambiguity, which corresponds to a situation of genuine freedom, and not pressure beyond. The second respect in which I think we have to expect to live in a pluralistic environment is related to a doctrine of creation. If God intends that creation continue, and God is in God's own self actively continuing to create, then we ought to expect a flourishing of different forms of piety. I don't think this is a loss. It is not a kind of a retrograde situation. It may fit the circumstances of God's plan for creation. Religion is historical. God is historical. God is an actual absolute, we were talking about last night. So that there will be an appropriate change. I think there's still some tendency in religious circles to regard God as a rock and not as a rapids. You know, that God is more in the stabilities and one might even say the rigidities of life than God is in the movement and flow and ongoingness. Walk along those streams and you think maybe the water suggests God as much as the rocks do. I hope that we as contemporary Christians will not fear change, will not fear the emergence of pluralism, will not sort of pull back and draw the wagon train around us and say, well, those people out there, they're different from us and different means bad. God is not locked up in the Christian church. God is at work in the world. And I think a pluralism fits the ongoing creation of God. Well, let me talk a little more about how the Christian then adapts herself or himself to this situation. I think there are two tendencies that I would want to warn against. It's probably easier to warn against tendencies than to suggest positive things, but it may still be helpful. I would say what I want to avoid is the technical word we're using here, which you probably recognize, is the word apologetics. That is to make an apology for, not in the sense of being ashamed for, but as 1 Peter has it, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that is in you, but do it with gentleness. 1 Peter 3:15. Apologetics, trying to give a reason for the hope that is in you, but do it with gentleness. Now, I think that gentleness recognizes the ambiguity again and respects freedom. There are two tendencies that I would worry about, either too much or too little, if you will. On the one hand, by too much I mean a position that assumes the truth of the Christian faith and uses the alleged truth of the Christian faith as a kind of basis to work muscle, leverage. For example, if someone says, you should accept Jesus as the divine word because the Bible tells me so. That's so obvious that I apologize to you in the other sense of apologize for using it. But if somebody doesn't accept the Bible, it's no value to say to that person, you should accept Jesus as the word of God because the Bible says, well, this person doesn't accept the Bible. Obviously, the question is, why accept the Bible? What I'm trying to argue against is that apologetics that assumes too much and simply argues in circular fashion. On the other hand, I think there is an apologetics, if you permit me to use that word a little bit here, which assumes too little, which acts as if the task of dialogue is to evacuate oneself of any commitments or any position. I remember in Moorhead when the Catholic-Protestant dialogue was just starting, and writer Tomte got together a group of people, as was his style, to have a dialogue. And the strange thing was it went rather badly because everybody was saying, well, I don't believe anything, you don't believe anything, let's talk. It was really not very helpful. And we have found in the ecumenical dialogues that it's very important that people recognize where they are personally and bring that witness, not in a dogmatic and kind of overbearing way, but nonetheless bring that witness. So I'm also wanting to avoid an apologetics which would be too little. Let me give you an illustration. I've been much influenced by the writings of Alfred North Whitehead. I think that has been clear along the way here. Another person who works in that tradition is Shubert Ogden. Ogden's approach to this whole area is to start with what he calls a primal faith. And he argues that everybody has a primal faith and that you can move sort of without a qualitative break from that prime. He says, why don't people commit suicide? I think Ogden would grant that people do commit suicide. But why don't we all commit suicide? It's because we have a primal faith in the worthwhileness of existence. And then he sort of tries to build on that step by step, and before you know it, abracadabra, we're all sort of Christians. And I don't think that works very well. I don't think it does the Christian faith a favor. And I think it's offensive to the non-Christian who has thought about these things, perhaps, and says, thank you very much, but I don't wish to be considered Christian. But they might confess a primal faith. They might say, yes, it takes some faith not to kill yourself. But that isn't equal to Christian. I mean, it's not the same thing, so don't lump them together. Although it may be a point of contact in the dialogue, I think. So an apologetics that asks for the relationship but doesn't seek too much or too little. Now, I've been talking about a doctrine of change, too strong a word, a doctrine, a notion of change, and that we should expect change. I don't mean that we should worship change. I think there are changes that are terrible. But at least we should correct the sort of maybe natural tendency of religious people to worship the stabilities, the rocks, not the rapids. I'd like to try to apply that to an individual conversation. If you are talking with a person in your family, in your workplace or wherever it might be, who is not a Christian, either through that person's initiative or through your own, what would you expect? What would be the... what does this lovely notion of change entail for individual relationships? I want to mention three things. Maybe they're so obvious that I insult you now, but the afternoon is well on, and it's been warm today, and maybe you can use this even so. Just three things, quite simple. I think each person should expect to contribute. I mean, there are certain implications from that. Talking time, for example. Spreading that out, a kind of due process rule. If you're only talking and not listening, something's gone screwy in this conversation. Secondly, I think each person should expect to learn to receive. I think if you go into a conversation with a person on a matter as fundamental as the Christian faith, and you really have a difference of position, you will see the faith differently in that conversation. I don't think you will come out of it unchanged. And then thirdly, David Rhodes asked a question about this from the side the other day, and I still agree with him, that there's a sense in which you'd have to say the outcome is unpredictable. You can't go in with the notion that of some kind of absolute confidence. One of my former teachers used, this is I think a little too dark a phrase, but used the phrase a theology of failure. He said you have to be prepared to fail. Well, I don't know if that's quite the right way to put it. But at least you have to be prepared that the person with whom you're speaking will not just sort of snap into position and agree with what you've said. So in that sense, a theology of failure. Those would be implications. Now, I think as we undergo and take on this task, there will be a new challenge to us. I want to talk about doing this work from underneath, if I can use that phrase. We certainly need at least one Latin phrase every day here, you know, so that you can impress people. I'm going to put down the finitum compax infinitum. This famous Latin phrase means it's a long way to Hartley.
Image-like.
Yeah. This means, of course, the finite is capable of the infinite. The finite is capable of the infinite. Finitum capax, infinity. This is the basic Lutheran teaching. The original context for this had to do with the Lord's Supper. The question was whether the body and blood of Christ were truly present in the bread and wine, or whether they were only sort of present by suggestion, by symbolical suggestion. The other position, the Calvinist position, says finitum non capax infinitum. The finite is not capable of the infinite. Bread and wine cannot really bestow the person, the blood and the body of Christ. And the Lutheran position is finitum capax. Now, I'm not here to talk about sacraments today, but I want to take this notion and apply it to theology. We should do theology with a finitum capax, that is, recognizing that theology talks about the finite. And our ordinary experience of life, our finite experience, is theologically very significant. There has been a tendency in Lutheran theology, unfortunately, to make a radical separation between theological statements and what you might call empirical, experiential statements. For example, take the doctrine of sin. There's been a tendency to say that sin is a purely theological category, which does not equal anything, no specifiable equivalent in ordinary experience. Sin is always before God. God apparently is up there.
Anyway, no.
Anyway, you know, not. You cannot translate it to any kind of political or psychological. None of that applies. I don't think that's going to work very well in the future. If we're going to be effective in our witness, if we're going to be persuasive as apologists for the Christian faith, we need to recognize that the finitum capax applies and has bearing so that I ought to be able to tell you what sin looks like in the empirical. What kind of a human relationship? I don't know. I haven't been able to attend very many of Rich's sessions on addiction, but I think he's talking about sin, probably. Although he certainly would say he's talking about illness. I recognize that. But I wonder if there may not be an element coming in there that we can't totally separate. So I think we need to work from below with human experience and try to find a way to talk, to translate our theological doctrine. It's a really good Lutheran question. Ken Knutson, the former president of the American Lutheran Church, many of you heard him speak, I'm sure, in his book, The Shape of the Question, makes the point, I think very effectively, that the question, what does this mean, as Luther puts it all the time in the Catechism, is actually a wonderful question. And we should not bluster and stammer when someone asks us, what does this mean in empirical terms, in human terms? For example, we say things like, you are simul justus et peccator. You are at the same time justified and yet a sinner. What does it mean? You know, if you're not permitted to use Latin, what does it mean? Those are entirely fair and appropriate challenges to the faith, to the spokesperson for the faith. I'm just asking for a more empirical, a more filled out human statement of the faith at this point. Now, what assets do we have in our effort to speak for the faith? I want to mention primarily two. One from within the faith and one from outside the faith in the dialogue. From within the faith, I want to talk about the reality of our own relationship with God. And if I've got the right sheet along here, I've got a couple of passages, of course, to read to you. This is not the subject for our whole series, but I think that one of the functions of our private, or if you prefer, personal relationship with God is to make us more open to the dialogue with others, less fearful, less touchy, more imaginative, more creative, more able to work for new imaginative formulations of the faith, less threatened by the other, less inclined to sort of clam up or talk endlessly. And I have two points in mind here. One is the notion that in one's nurture of a personal relationship with God, one opens oneself. As one relates to God, one opens oneself to the rest of the world. One becomes more able to handle conflict and less intimidated by it. I have a statement, of course, to read. I collect statements. But I think this is a very good one by Anglican theologian Charles Scott. And it goes like this. Talking about prayer as communion, the communion with God. Not a lot of talk, but the sense of communion. And this is what he has to say. Communing happens as an awareness of things free of intent. This openness does not posit anything. How in particular I live, how the church lives, how the tree comes forth, isn't that interesting, being out here at Holden? How the church comes forth, how my neighbor is, all things may be as they are. Communion happens as a disclosure of beings without prescription, in the clear openness of human being. That primary freedom of world openness is not a self-relationship. It is not clearly a subject-object relationship. It is released to the realm of appearances, a release in which one's own particular identity fades back and one's awareness occurs without desire or interest. Now that may strike you as very romantic, but Mr. Scott is talking about a form of prayer, which is communion, meditation, openness, without a big agenda. You know, most of our prayer is kind of a laundry list approach to prayer, where we know these six things that should happen before 10:40. And I don't mean to satirize that, because I think it's appropriate to ask to pray with intercession. But there's another form of prayer that gets so easily neglected, and that is simply the sense of communion, in which you open yourself, and you're not trying to change everything. You recognize that God is present, and not everything depends upon your prayer. You're kind of turned open to the world. This closely relates to a change in one's own perception of oneself. And I want to quote, I won't quote too much more now, but I think I have 23 more quotes here. But I want to quote Anne Belford Ulanoff, who is a Jungian analyst teaching in New York City, practicing in New York City. What happens to ourselves, what she's talking about, a lovely passage for you, what she's talking about is how we get locked into false perceptions of ourselves. And in the relationship with God, there is a breaking open, talk about a kind of cross, a scouring, an annihilation of those false images and an opening of ourselves to God. I think this is worth reading. In prayer, we recollect ourselves and we feel touched by what or who we know ourselves to be. We recover a sense of ourselves, now disidentified somewhat from the different roles we take on during each day. For finally, in prayer, I am I, for better or worse before God, and not mother or teacher or wife or lover or some identity I share with my depressed or anxious or dulled feelings. We do not reach this glimpse of the essential self except by sorting through all the feelings, ambitions, and needs that preoccupy us in our days, with which we tend to identify ourselves. In this sorting process, we identify to ourselves the kinds of reactions that have captured our attentions, and we stand aside from them, disidentifying them as central marks of who and what we are. We can then discover the false gods that have obstructed our way to God. And we can discover this by letting God touch us. This is in the Anglican Theological Review from 1978. I think she's got something. We get so locked into a particular conception, set into a particular role, and one of the things that we have for the dialogue is the capacity to be changed in our own sense of ourselves. And I think that will make us much more effective, less defensive, less preoccupied with ourselves. Easy to read quotes about it, it's harder to do it. But I hope the reading of the quotes helps a little bit. The other thing I said I think we have for this prospect of the ongoing dialogue, besides the inner nurturing of prayer and communion, where we open ourselves to the world and change our conceptions of ourselves, the other is, I think, a new earnestness in the secular world, a new sense of, if you will, need, a new sense of peril, crisis. I think there is some sense in which the human extremity is God's opportunity. And I think that there is a sense now in which people are more prepared to take seriously ultimate questions. Though that doesn't mean that they're ready to buy any particular answer. But I think that the fact that the church has survived the alleged death of God, God is not dead, the church even is not dead. And people are showing a new interest. So I have some passages that witness to that, but I think I will not read them. Even Robert Bella, at the end of Habits of the Heart, has a kind of, for a sociologist, has a remarkable sort of wistful, or that's too weak, hopeful tone, where he says, well, we've been through the worst of this individualism. Maybe there is now a recognition that we have to come together in a sense in which we do need a communal and corporate identity. I'm nearly done with what I wanted to present. Maybe it works just as well to finish the couple of things further I wanted to say, and then we'll have some minutes for conversation. So I won't go much longer. We're talking about the future for faith, and especially the future of the dialogue between faith and unfaith. And I wanted to mention two issues that I think are absolutely crucial in this next period of years, to which we must attend, and which I think are not very far along for us. These are the issues represented by the feminist movement and issues present in the dialogue with other religions. Just to take the second for a minute first, it seems to me that it's clearly the case that every community, well, maybe that's too strong, I don't know every community, but the presence of the other great world faiths is certainly a widespread presence in our time. When I was growing up, Buddhism, well, that was from over there, and Hinduism was over there. It isn't true anymore, of course. One of the women who was here was telling, I think somebody was mentioning that in her home area there was such a community. And we all know that you don't have to go to the state universities to find these communities. They are often in rural areas. How shall we think about the relationship of the Christian faith to the other great world faiths? That question is an urgent one that challenges the church. All I want to say about this, and maybe we'll have some talk about this together, all I want to say about this is to point out three or four unhelpful responses that we can avoid. And then I hope avoiding those unhelpful responses, we can move into the conversation. I think one unhelpful response, way of approaching this, would be to say that only the Christian faith is true. It seems to me this is a very difficult thing to say. If your criterion is the response which persons seem to make, if you're going to take a phenotype cop box, if you're going to say that the way people live, the peace, the serenity, the beauty of their lives, that would be a phenotype cop box kind of criterion that you can see some experience, then the Christian faith is not obviously infinitely superior to some other faith positions. Moreover, if the God of the Christian faith has been trying for 2,000 years or longer to reach all of these people, and all that God has been able to do is to get this struggling little band of Christians, that isn't much. So I think we have to work somehow with the doctrine of general revelation, that God is known and is present to these other faiths. How much is there in terms of an actual God relationship, I think becomes an empirical question. An empirical question which we need to attend to. We need more people who are willing to spend time seriously living in other cultures, engaging those people, coming to know their faith as much as you can without, I mean, you are in some sense still an outsider, but it's one thing to read about it in a book. Many of us haven't done that much. Another thing to live with those people. So I think it won't work simply to, I think it, the justice of such a position that God would have no place in God's kingdom for people who are not Christians, the justice of that position seems very doubtful. A second thing that I think needs to be avoided is, a second unhelpful response would be to say that there is no truth to be had, that these are all simply matters of opinion or expression of taste, but there is no truth question. Closely related to this would be, maybe almost the same, I think a little different, would be to say, thirdly, that all the religions are true. Either there's no truth to be had, or they all have it. Well, that just about comes out the same. I think, again, that gives up the effort. I think what we need is to be discriminate. We need to be critical and yet open. John Gardner talks about a critical lover and a loving critic. We need to be open to those people and yet bring our own judgments, our own witness, and in a sense our own criticism. Finally, as an unhelpful response, I think it is not good to sort of make the conversation itself the religion, as if you could somehow create a world faith out of the conversation. We need to maintain our base in the community, our own community. I have a little notion here to offer you. I don't know if it'll strike you as too elliptical, but these other faiths are other. I don't think the approach is to somehow suggest that all the faiths are saying the same thing. They're really other. But then God is other than we are. And maybe in the experience of the other, small o, we begin to get some sense of the experience of the other, capital O, that God is not simply one like us. For example, in Eastern faiths, the source of transcendence is often described in impersonal terms, as if there is no God really, and yet there is a transcendent relationship. I don't know much about that, but some of my colleagues who work more with the field talk that way about it. Well, maybe that helps us to not be too quick to assume that God is sort of one large person like us, but there is a mystery in God. There's an otherness in God, and maybe the otherness of the other faith. There's a sense in which, by exposing ourselves to the other faiths, the otherness of God can be made. Our tendency toward idolatry, our tendency to kind of create God in our image, that tendency can be corrected by passing through that dialogue with the other faith. I also think, I know the time is not much longer with us here, just quickly on this second issue, I certainly think that we have not attended in the Christian church sufficiently to the experience of women. And there are many ways in which this bears upon our situation. I think just to mention a couple of them, it seems to me that the feminist theologians are emphasizing much more the themes of creativity and becoming and change, rather than the themes of being and the sort of more substance-oriented theologies. They are also challenging our concept of power, not just the way the power has been distributed in the past, but the very notion of power over rather than power with, or power together. I have a quote from Rosemary Radford Ruther that I thought to read, which I think expresses this challenge in a somewhat helpful way. Humanity can be reconciled with God only if God is converted from his patriarchalism to become the ground of reciprocity in creation. The death of God the Father is the overthrowing of the alienated image of male egoism in heaven, which sanctifies all relations of domination and subjugation in the world in order that the new covenant of life can appear. This is the new creation glimpsed but unrealizable under a patriarchal gospel. I think the point that she is making is that we have to reconceive the concept of power. She's talking about a ground of reciprocity. God is the ground of reciprocity in the new creation. That isn't the image of kind of a substance power, but a power in reciprocal relationships. Another person who has done that and has written of that in really eloquent and excellent ways, I think, is Zola. And I thought to read a couple of passages from her and let these people speak somewhat for themselves. I think you get the same kind of tone of a radical reconception. Now, one of the questions that's come in my presentations is the question about whether we are somehow losing the sense of abyss, mystery. I think Zola still has that. Listen to this. This is from her suffering book. We don't have the choice of avoiding suffering and going around death. The only choice we have is between the absurd cross of meaninglessness and the cross of Christ. The death we accept apathetically as a natural end, and the death we suffer as a passion. And then just a little bit more from the same section. We can also speak of an enduring affirmation of life that arises in the dark night of the cross. This formulation avoids the appearance that it is necessary to always have an experience of the light. The mystical experience of the night of the cross and the light within the night is not dependent upon an absolute clarity of the relationship with God. Well, she's talking about the struggle to redefine the concepts in the Christian faith in such a way that we don't require a substance conception. I have one other passage from Zola that I wanted to read. Now, this may strike you as a little too tame, but I think it's helpful. That God can wipe away tears can no longer be accepted in a direct sense. The 14-year-old Jewish boy is dead. She's talking about a boy that was killed in the concentration camp. Well, from what face will God wipe away the tears? The God conceived of in that way as a kind of specific substance who could fix everything up in the universe. But God conceived of in that way comes too late. But if God is not thought of as an alien superior power, but as that which occurs between people, now there again you get that theme of reciprocity between people. Now maybe that strikes you as too little, but it's a rich theme that God is that one working between us, not just, it's not my God or your God, not the male God or the female God, but the God that works between us, radically altering the concept of power. I shouldn't break into these quotes. But if God is not thought of as an alien superior power, but as that which occurs between people, then the relationship to this child does not end with death. Then it is not over and done with in the course of an individual life. Because the lives that child affected are going on, and God is working with those lives as the ground of reciprocity. That would be your point. Well, there are many other things we may want to talk about there. The final thing I wanted to say was just how much is enough. then I will mercifully stop. Now you might say, well, if you really want to know how much is enough, what you've said is quite enough, and you should stop. But nobody said that, so I will continue. The question I want to make here, just at the very end, before we turn to our discussion, is it really a rather personal question. I have, in my 5 presentations, I think, raised questions that are difficult. I don't think they are straw questions. I don't think these are just easy things that can be dismissed with a wave of a hand. One person told me after one of my sessions, she said, I think you told us more about the questions than the answers. And it's conceivable that might be your attitude at this point. I think that it's very helpful to recognize that we are in a less sort of fortress position. There are many questions that are not just outside of us, but in us probably. They're in me, and I suspect they may be in some of you. We struggle. We don't have it all put together. How much faith is enough? That's the question I'm putting here at the end. Are you hypocritical to stay? The mountains are beautiful, but should you really come to Holden? You know, I mean, because there's a little religious stuff here. Should you continue? Well, how much is enough? I have a quote from Anne Sexton, a poet, in a book called The Awful Rowing Toward God. This is a little bit differently worded, but I think it will not offend you. My faith is a great weight hung on a small wire. God does not need too much wire to keep God there. Just a thin vein and some love, even a small love. So if you have only a thin wire, God does not mind. Well, I think she has it right. That is, our faith is struggling and frail. God is willing to have his bestow and willing to work. Let's take some minutes now to talk. Listen to me.
Well, sure, just one thing. You mentioned God is known in his presence with other faiths. You mentioned Buddhism.
Yep.
My sister teaches at the International School in Bangkok, Thailand. I'm sure I've talked to some of you about this. She mentioned the other day, she was in a hotel where they often stop to do the paper and have some juice. And the clerk that was waiting on she and her husband was a Thai girl. And they had become kind of friendly with her, spoke with her a little bit. She had a chain around her neck with a pendant on the bottom. And so they said to her, tell us about your pendant. And she said, it was a pendant of Buddha. She said, same your God.
Mm-hmm. I have a book here. Thank you for that incident. Beyond Dialogue. Now, this is a very ambitious book. This is checked out of the Holden Library, by the way, which I'll return after this session. But it's nice to have all these books here. You know, like 2 suitcases of books when you come. But anyway, the title, Beyond Dialogue, is... I'll be all right.
We're okay, we're not sure about you.
Is that it's not enough to just dialogue, and that we may well expect something new. John Kopp says, Christianity and Buddhism are not the same religion. They're not the same, so that we don't just... And so he could not say... He was born in China, and he's been very active. He was a missionary kid. He's been very active in the Buddhist-Christian dialogues. But he doesn't know what will come. You know, maybe not just same God, but if you really interact with someone, when you married that other person, you weren't the same person you are now. The marriage has changed both of you. Now, I don't mean that this is necessarily a marriage, but it's a dialogue, conversation. You won't come out the same. I don't think we know where that'll be in 10 years. The people out on the front line. I think the closest would be the great teleological religions, namely Judaism and Islam, where you have a strong emphasis upon a personal God, and you have a very prophetic element and a sense of history. So those are faiths which they're not the same as Christianity. But they do have many of the same, you might say, formal or metaphysical characteristics. I'm speaking as if I know what I'm talking about, but I don't. But I mean, this is a vast field. But I still think that's the case. I would say. Secondly, I think that the ones that are most different for me are the ones which sort of relinquish any sense of personal deity. Some forms of Confucianism, some forms of Taoism. I like kind of what William James said when he said that for the person who's been reared in the Western world with a sense of history and a sense of self and other and relationship, it's very hard to believe in a kind of nirvana where everything sinks into a seamless web or an ocean and identity seems to be lost. Now, maybe it's not as hard for the Christian mystic. I think it would be harder for me to be involved in those kinds of things. There seems to me to be such a radically different view of what reality is. But I don't want to be too sure about that. But, you know, in trying to respond to your question, I guess that's what I would say. I don't want to make it sound like these are all the same. They're very different, you know.
Just a practical question. Is there considerable or not so considerable interest in part of the leadership of these faiths to dialogue with Christian
church?
Is that happening?
I don't know about any real formal approaches or overtures. There may be such. I know of regional different settings where individuals who represent the different faiths quite on their own initiative have engaged, have entered into serious conversation. Incidentally, there are two initiatives that I think are kind of exciting. The American Lutheran Church's Board of World Missions and Interchurch Cooperation has been studying the other faiths. And there's a group starting this summer, for example, on Buddhism. And there are Buddhologists. Frederick Strang, for example, who teaches at Southern Methodist University. I think that's where he is. And he's a Lutheran. He's very well known in the field of Buddhology, study of Buddhism, will be in that team. Some other people, some parish pastors, some seminary people. That's one thing just in our own American Lutheran Church. And then on the more national or international level, there's a study team headed by Paul Rajashekhar, who is an Indian from the country of India, an Indian Christian, who is heading up a study team of the relationship of Christian faith to other religions. This will be done from within the parameters of Christian faith, but in a genuine attempt to engage those faiths. That's under the Lutheran World Federation's auspices. So I think there are some fortunate signs. And you're perhaps asking me that.
And why? Why do you think so?
Well, if I could give you an answer to the why, then I would have something more important than what I just said. So,
I mean, why? I just don't know what.
What? Okay. Well. Certainly one of them would be that God is a God who wills to be for humankind, wills to bless all humankind, is for us, and that would be empirically stateable. God aims for the flourishing of human life, as opposed to a view that's distinguished from a view where God is simply sort of a metaphysical power or the power working in all things. So a moral conception of God, moral stateable in human terms, that would be one. A second would be that the Christian faith has a strong doctrine of creation, of the affirmation of the goodness of creation, the goodness of life, the preciousness of relationship. I wouldn't want to give that up. I think I would also want to make a third, and I think one can't have many more than three. I think I would want to make a third be somewhere in the area that for the Christian, there is a decisiveness about the person and the work of Jesus of Nazareth. Something happened there, something key. I tried to talk about that last night in terms of particular doctrinal formulations. So that we aren't simply sort of anonymous religious beings, but we are Christians. I guess those would be primary notions. I think that was a little thing with the staff. one evening. And I believe that, though, that I haven't said that in the large group, I don't think, that not all doctrines are on the same level for anyone. And I try to get my students at the seminary to kind of own up to what's most important for them, what's at the center, rather than a kind of flatland approach to theology where you have 631 doctrines and you memorize them all for catechism class. I don't think that's... What's the core for a person? And that would be part of this, too. The core would probably be something that would be in your experience, or at least pertaining to your experience. Well, I think the time is about gone. I want to thank the people here very much, and you people. I was thinking first of Jody and Ingrid. I don't see Elmer here just now. But anyway, for the powers that be, for inviting me to come. And I want to thank you for coming to these sessions. I've really been pleased with the liveliness. You people bear with me, it seems. You have a capacity to suffer incoherence and somehow survive.
An endless quote.
You're really very gracious. Thank you very much.